I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. An eerie suspense hangs over the post-Puerto Rico moment, seas rising, spirits falling, awareness dawning, self-destruction full steaming ahead by carbon overload. The utopian novelist Kim Stanley Robinson strikes a key note this hour that the future, and maybe a point of no return, has arrived way ahead of anybody's hunch or schedule. He has written that future in vivid detail in a cult novel called New York 2140. Manhattan half drowned by then, regentrifying again, people surfing the waves between Herald Square and Central Park. But in that novel of 2140, Stan Robinson dated his picture more than a century out. Today, though, 2017, it's a plausible dystopia just a decade or two away. He took us through the scene as if by kayak this week on the phone from California.
Sea level rise is one of the hardest things to predict because it's a matter of ice perched on Antarctica and how quickly will it melt and slide off into the sea. James Hansen and 18 co-authors last year published a paper indicating that in the historical past, the Paleolithic past, there were times when a slight rise of temperature, which we've already achieved, resulted in a massive sea level rise. So they've made a case that is not compelling, but it is suggestive. So I followed that. So 50 feet is radical, but if all the ice on the planet were to melt, it would be 220 feet sea level rise. So it isn't that radical. So I chose 50 feet to get lower Manhattan underwater all the time. And by that, I mean from about the Empire State Building south to Battery Park.
And there are new hives of rich people uptown, new hives of very poor people half submerged in Chelsea and such places. Some people, strangely enough, even the poor, are feeling better off. How does this happen?
Well, I've spent some time in Venice, and it's quite lovely there. And once you get rid of cars, urban life becomes better. Cars are a disaster for cities. And so I was thinking along these lines. New York is always New York. It's a great harbor. It's a beautiful spot. It's already got a massive, well-built infrastructure, and people are going to stick around. And also, material science is developing so fast that there are going to be some composites that could result in even taller skyscrapers than we build now. So the north end of Manhattan is well above 50 feet above sea level, from Central Park all the way up to the Cloisters, except for a small low point at 125th Street, is all high enough that you could continue to build there, and New York could continue to build New York. And the gentrification, the income inequality that we're seeing now, it could get worse. Rich people could continue to stash a billion or two in New York to have a little vacation sky apartment. And poor people would be dealing with crappy conditions, but they already are. So in a way, a super Venice and an intertidal zone that is legally problematical as to who owns what. And between squatting and new forms of ownership and giving up on drowned buildings that then could be resuscitated by way of new material science, you get a kind of possibility for new forms of social organization, essentially like the co-ops that already happen in condominiums in New York.
It's fascinating, too, that the financial capital is still right there, rich and poor. Who's happy? Who's angry? Who's in a revolutionary mood? Who's not?
Well, let's say that most of us are in the precariat, because the 1%, incredibly rich and wealthy, they've got anxieties because they've got security guards and crazy children and tax accountants. And so scientifically, solid studies have showed that once you begin to make more than about $100,000 a year, your mental health gets worse rather than better. But everybody else is in the precariat, which means that your job, your health care, your pension are all precarious. And if you were to lose your job or lose your health, every bit of your security could go away. Well, nobody likes that. So that's where the focus of change will come.
What are the jobs people are doing, fighting for in 2141?
All the jobs that we have now, plus maybe more emphasis on education, caring for the young, caring for the old, and caring for the environment. These are all labor intensive. Robots can't do any of them. The whole notion that employment will go away is another bad science fiction story that won't come true. There's a kind of techno silver bullet libertarian nerd solution coming out of Silicon Valley that is a science fiction scenario for our future that just simply isn't going to happen. It's filled with false assumptions.
You're a man with an imagination and a very strong education behind you. I know you're a student of the postmodernist Frederick Jameson, also a Philip K. Dick science fiction man going back to your youth. Where would you say you're coming from? Not exactly science. What is it?
No, I'm an English major. I'm an American leftist. My political education comes from Frederick Jameson and from the 60s, 70s American left, anti-Vietnam, California hippie. Also, Gary Snyder and his California Buddhism, an important component of my thinking. Also, I'm a member of the science fiction community. So all these things have helped to form me.
How does that community behind you, your reading, your life, affect your vision, do you think?
I'm used to thinking about the present as being the first step in a history that will keep on happening and that it will be constrained by the laws of physics. And then beyond that, almost anything could happen. So we could get utopia, we could get catastrophe. And science fiction is a good way to think about right now, because what happens is you think, well, what's going on right now that will lead to a positive future? And what's going on right now that will lead to disaster? And can we push towards the positive? So this is sort of the science fiction habit of mine.
What's driving us these days?
What's driving us is quarterly profit and shareholder value. We are in late capitalism, and the free market took over about the time of the Reagan-Thatcher counter-revolution against the FDR New Deal. We have been under the belief system that the markets will figure out everything correctly, essentially calling the markets the king and becoming citizens of a monarchy that is money. Everything is underpriced. We're wrecking both people's lives and the environment by systemically cheating the future generations in a kind of a universal multi-generational Ponzi scheme where we don't pay the full cost of what we do, and future generations do pay the cost. And so you can't really call the next stage of the world economy any name that we've ever used before without bringing in all kinds of historical baggage. It should have aspects of socialism because we need to socialize risk. We need to socialize the necessities, food, water, shelter, clothing, healthcare, education. All these should be things that everybody has a right to and that gets together at adequacy. And then beyond that, what remains of capitalism is maybe the toys and the games and the explorations into zones that don't really matter for the fundamental necessities. It's frightening.
The injustice of it is so stark and obvious in the season of storms 2017, between the high ground and the Caribbean, for example. What are we learning and where is it getting to us in heart, mind, politics, or anything else?
Well, that's a really good question. It depends which story you believe. Gramsci, the Italian theorist, talked about hegemony, that everybody lives according to an order that is actually bad for them without guns actually being in their faces. So hegemony is a matter of which story you believe and how you conduct your affairs because you believe in one story rather than another. So right now, the dominant free market story crashed badly in 2008. It should have been a time of complete emperor is no clothes type realization that we need a new system. In fact, a lot of people tried to go on as if 2008 hadn't happened and hadn't revealed the lack of coherence and the lack of ability of capitalism to take care of us. But nevertheless, that was a huge crack in the edifice. And now we are in this moment of uncertainty of trying to figure out what comes next.
Yeah.
I mean, one reaction has been Trump, a kind of a reaction to say, we need to blow up the system and we'll use a fool to do it because we don't have any other tool.
Can you say who's winning at this point or even draw the pictures of the worst and the best that could be possible?
Yes. And who's winning? I think we're on a fence and you can't say who's winning. This is part of the unpredictability of the future, but there's lots of hopeful signs. The Paris Accord was huge. It was a historical moment that will go down in any competent world history, even if it's written like 5,000 years from now. That moment when all of the nation states said, we have to put a price on carbon. We have to go beyond capitalism and regulate our entire economy and our technological base in order to keep the planet alive. Now, it's true the Paris Accord only got us to about half of the carbon reduction that we need to get, but that would have been by 2040. And the interesting question is the first half harder or is the second half harder? And we would find that out only by doing it. So the worldwide awareness of the situation, the kind of fact that we are a global village and that everybody on this planet knows the basic facts of the situation, everybody knows everything. So this is the great positive. So against that, power, money, they need to have the story changed. They need to realize they can't escape to a mansion island, that their kids are going to be just as screwed as everybody else's kids. This is the story that has to be told, and this is the battle that we're in.
Can you share your vision of two endings when the fence collapses?
I mean, there's the simple utopia-dystopia. The utopia is that we actually get a grip and create a sustainable civilization that's in balance with the planet. And that means that fully 8 billion humans could live at adequacy and very happily with all the rest of the biosphere, including all the rest of the big mammals. And there would be, you know, E.O. Wilson's half-earth idea that a lot of land be left to the other animals while the humans congregate in the cities. And clean tech, social justice, women's rights, which actually stabilizes population very quickly. And then a post-capitalist system that regulates all this and makes it work. That's the utopian possibility that is quite possible in terms of physics. Then the bad one is simply a mass extinction event where we kill off all the large mammals except for our own domestic beasts. And we ourselves are hammered. Agriculture goes south. The oceans go south. The first food crisis, world culture will be so stressed that it will become a fight of all against all. It probably will be so bad you only get a few decades of absurd badness followed by a post-traumatic attempt to recover. And also, you can't come back from extinctions. That's the dystopia, mass extinction event. But these are extremes, and I guess the last thing I'd say is that the middle, where you sort of think, well, it'll probably be about halfway in between those two, that doesn't work. It falls off sharply, one direction or the other. There isn't a middle zone anymore. Because if we stumble along like we are now, we're going to tilt off into dystopia. If we fix things, we're going to slide off into utopia. We have come to a bad moment where we have to change.
Kim Stanley Robinson has been called the real humanist in speculative fiction, a.k.a. Cli-Fi, for climate fiction. New York, 2140, is his account of the edge we're all on. Coming up, techno fixes worth talking about, and some that may not be. This is Open Source. Greg Lindsay is another sort of futurist, urban engineer, writer, two-time Jeopardy winner against IBM's Watson. You say the future is still cities, Greg, but cities transformed. You've got a nasty hypothetical on your blog. 5 or 6 years down the road, Hurricane Hermine has devastated our Atlantic seacoast. Real estate values have cratered. The coastline rules have all been rewritten. Where are you leading us, Greg?
Welcome. I'm leading us in... Well, thank you for having me. I'm leading us into a future that is neither utopia nor dystopia. It is a near future, at least, in which we simply cope with the hand that we're being dealt. This is a world in which, you know, instead of mega hurricanes hitting us 5 years from now, they're hitting us every week, it seems. But it's one in which, you know, the various states are redrawing their own futures, in which the future is becoming something more local because we no longer seem to place our trust in federal institutions.
Who's running New York? Who's the president when Hermine strikes?
Well, in 2022, it's President Trump in his second term. The governors in New York and New Jersey are Governor Cuomo and Governor John Bon Jovi, elected in 2021. And, you know, shortly thereafter, in this speculative future, which we designed for the Regional Plan Association here in New York, President Mark Zuckerberg is elected in 2024 on his campaign promise of universal basic income, providing an income for the people who lost everything in the crash of 23.
Does he have a party behind him?
He does not. He has the Silicon Valley Party behind him, exactly the people that Kim Stanley Robinson fears, the California ideology made flesh in the form of Mark.
Greg, what big adjustments will have been made in 5 to 10 years? I mean, and who's in the fight over it?
Well, I mean, several things are happening now when it comes to climate change in the United States. One is that we're seeing the states are striking out on their own. California, of course, is the most prominent. You know, by an interesting twist of fate, they have the ability to regulate their own air emissions, a power granted to them by Governor Ronald Reagan back in 1967 that was grandfathered in by the EPA. So California might be the first to mutiny against any major rollback of EPA standards. And ironically there, Tom Pruitt, you know, the secretary or the head of the EPA, I should say, you know, was the attorney general of Oklahoma who sued the Obama administration. So now we might see states suing them to basically maintain their own laws. So, you know, the states will be leading the fight.
And getting what kind of results if suppose they win?
Well, suppose they win, it'll be tied up in the courts for years, but they'll be allowed to set their own emissions. They'll be able to force industry to follow along. And when it comes to electricity, for example, to choose the most obvious example, you know, we've already seen 20 states have achieved market parity with fossil fuel. So we have a federal administration that wants to bring back coal, that wants to drill in the Arctic, but we've already seen states that have made it economically infeasible to do so. And so it's going to be the sort of, you know, divergent futures where you just won't see it in some states because it doesn't make any economic sense.
You're our scout for techno fixes that, you know, might counter despair, might even work, Greg. Like what?
Well, I mean, when it comes to energy, for example, it's the fact that solar is accelerating way faster than anyone thought. I mean, the International Energy Agency, which is the gold standard on this, this year outstripped even their most optimistic predictions. So there's a quiet revolution happening there. And it's something that happens, it can happen at a decentralized level too. You can have solar panels anywhere. You don't need giant grids. You can start rethinking your whole energy levels. There's huge advances in bioscience that are happening that no one's really paying attention to. We hear about CRISPR, for example, and genetic engineering. But, you know, what that could do for fuels, what that could do for food, a second green revolution could happen there. We just don't know yet.
Greg, you mentioned the news that really hasn't broken in the States, that the price of energy is about to fall off a cliff thanks to radical breakthroughs in the storage of sun and wind power. The Canadian journalist Chris Turner introduced us this week to a Danish island in the Baltic where artists have always been drawn to the sunlight and technologists have now gone to capture it.
The Danish island of Bornholm is a small, largely agrarian island just off the coast of Sweden, actually. And it has been the site for the last 3-4 years now of possibly the world's most ambitious smart grid experiment. So this is an island that already gets the majority of its electricity from renewable sources, predominantly wind. The Danish government and a handful of other expert agencies and IBM and Siemens and some other big companies all went in and outfitted 1,900 homes and businesses with the latest and greatest technology, brought some electric cars to the island, basically set up that sort of next generation of how we're going to live next. And to imagine a day there, you would park your car at night, plug it in so that it could power up on the cheap because we have more wind at night, so it doesn't cost too much at night. Get up the next day, drive to work in your electric car, plug it back into the grid. It's going to sit in the parking lot all day anyway, and broker power back to the grid when it's needed by other consumers during the day at a profit potentially. And then you go home in the evening to your smart gridded home where your appliances have been making wise decisions and saving you money all day by not demanding energy when it's at its highest price. And basically all of the everyday needs of modern life are taken care of faster, cheaper, and more efficiently.
What part of that could you not do, Chris Turner, in Staten Island or in Puerto Rico for that matter?
None of it. It's not a question of technical ability. It's a question essentially of political will and some economics and a few other things. So absolutely, if the powers that be on the island of Puerto Rico and the United States government decided instead of building or rebuilding a very, very fragile, rigid conventional grid and all of the accoutrements, we are going to make Puerto Rico the model of this next generation. There's absolutely nothing from a technical standpoint that would stop them.
I keep wondering, do we know this subconsciously? I've heard, but you don't read it in the newspaper, that within the next 5 years, absolutely the next 10, wind and solar energy will not only outproduce coal and oil, but they'll be cheaper. And that smart people are already somehow discounting or getting prepared for this good news.
That is absolutely the case. The cost of adding new electricity to the grid in much of the world, possibly within 5 years, certainly within 10, wind and solar are going to be the cheapest way to do that, or as cheap as anything else at the very least. And that's already the case in certain really, really high quality jurisdictions for solar and that sort of thing. And I think that's why you're seeing, for example, India is making huge investments in solar power, using solar power instead of conventional grid to go to places that have never had electricity at all. And they're not doing that because the Modi government is so enlightened. They're doing that because it's the most cost-effective way to do it in those parts of India. And I don't think that that's a trend that's going to go away. What we've seen with the renewables is an extraordinary collapse in price. Just, you know, unprecedented, really wasn't predicted. No one, even the most sort of optimistic boosters of the stuff 5-10 years ago, did not see the price coming down this quickly. And as the price comes down, it becomes more ubiquitous, and it's a feedback loop that amplifies itself.
There are lots more techno fixes in Chris Turner's book, The Geography of Hope. Naomi Oreskes joins us, Harvard historian of science and policy skeptic, too. We know you, Naomi, for the book Merchants of Doubt, about the corporate science that hid the truth about tobacco and global warming. Pick up where Chris Turner just left off. I mean, what stands in the way of Puerto Rico and the rest of us getting that cheap, plentiful solar and wind power?
Well, I largely agree with what we just heard. I think there is a really important good news story here about technology. And as we just heard, even more, I think, than it's not just an island off the coast of Sweden. All around the world, there is an energy revolution taking place in India, in Spain, in Australia. And it's really shocking how little we hear about it in the United States. So if you travel and go to other places, you hear about this a lot, and you see evidence of it everywhere you go. I was in Australia 2 years ago where I saw amazing prototype installations of passive solar heating and cooling. There's some amazing things taking place with innovative approaches to agriculture, using solar power to desalinate water in the coast of South Australia. So these things are absolutely happening all around the world. So I think that argument is exactly right. The problem is scale. They're not happening at the scale we need, and they're not happening fast enough. So even though the price of solar is plummeting, it's not just in a few enlightened places where it's cheaper. There was a big piece in Bloomberg News about a year ago, and I'm trying to remember the exact number, but it was something like 60 countries around the world, including many developing nations, where solar is now cheaper. Newly installed solar is now the cheapest form of newly installed electrical capacity. So this is really, really good news. But the giant question is, how do we scale this up? And that's where some of the issues that Stan was talking about kick in. Issues about regulation, issues about tax structure, issues about the perverse incentives that keep fossil fuels cheap in many places, utility activities that are blocking people from selling their solar power back to the grid in places where they'd like to do that. So there's a lot of structural impediments. Some of them are inertia associated with regulations that are simply out of date. Some of it is brutal political power by the fossil fuel industry. And the other really important piece is investment. There was just a piece in the paper just yesterday about how around the world, major banks, including many banks that have touted that they now have green investment policies, are still continuing to make major loans to oil, gas, and even coal investment, new coal development projects. So we have sort of two different trends. So again, here I agree with both of the previous speakers. Yes, there's this really optimistic story to be told about technology, but there's also, as Stan Robinson said, a kind of, this can go two ways. We have this great technology that we need to be investing in, but strangely, insanely, we are still investing in new fossil fuel infrastructure. And those two pictures are very much at odds with each other.
Let me ask, though, Naomi, I mean, strangely, politically, we know the horror of the Trump administration at this kind of turn away from fossil fuel, not to mention the Koch brothers who seem to own Congress. Can they stop something as, you know, in a market society, can they stop something as powerful as what we're hearing about sun and wind?
Well, I think it's really important for people to understand this is not just about the Trump administration. The massive subsidies to fossil fuels have been going on for a century. And I've been talking about this for years, long before Donald Trump was ever elected or before anybody even imagined he would be elected. The World Bank issued a big report on fossil fuel subsidies about, I want to say it's 5 or 6 years ago now, in which they estimated that simply direct subsidies to fossil fuel around the globe every year, direct, so not including the indirect subsidies like the cost of wars in the Middle East or the health effects, $500 billion every single year. That's the same as the troubled asset recovery program, right? So that's talking
right.
That fossil fuels are a troubled asset. But this has been going on for a long, long time, and it's not just the United States and it's not Donald Trump. It's a much bigger issue. And so we all need to get involved, people who are involved in investment, people who are involved in banking, people who care about the tax code, people who care about where their taxes are going, which is essentially everyone. It's sort of a geekish issue that most people don't pay attention to. Most climate activists have no idea. I mean, it's starting to be a conversation.
Yeah, but stand by. I mean, subsidies like the Trump administration, new environmental rules, you know, the lobbyist's dream, that will open up more coal mining leases in public lands, for instance. But do Scott Pruitt and the fossil industries really believe that after these storms we're going back as they pretended to burning coal?
Well,
really?
I'm not a mind reader. I can't say what they really believe in their hearts or what they dream about when they go to bed at night. But I think it's implausible to suggest that they don't know the truth. I think they don't care. And I think they don't care for a variety of reasons. I mean, if we look at the work we did in Merchants of Doubt.
Let's talk about it.
Yeah, well, what we learned from that work, looking at, you know, people would often ask me, well, did the tobacco industry executives really not think that tobacco caused cancer? No, we know that they knew that it caused cancer, but they had a narrative. They had a story in their own minds that justified what they did. And for tobacco executives, the story usually went something like this. People are grown-ups. They can make up their own mind. This is a free society, and in a democratic society, we don't want the government telling us what to do. And if you let the government tell you whether or not you can smoke cigarettes, it's only a matter of time before you lose your other freedoms as well.
I'm sure you're following that suit, obviously,
yeah,
against ExxonMobil.
Yeah, so we've seen that exact argument made for climate change, and I think there are people who use it completely cynically and know that it's hogwash from top to bottom, but I also think there are people who buy into it and they persuade themselves that they actually are protecting freedom. Of course, it's not true. You know, look at what's happened to people in Puerto Rico. I mean, there's no freedom when you have no food and no water and electricity. But I think the power of rationalization is very, very great.
Greg, I want your take on the collision of interests here, and especially around solar and wind.
Well, you know, it's fascinating how in Texas, for example, you know, Texas Republicans have come to the aid of wind power because they realize how good it's been for the state. So there, their actual local interests, where they see what renewables can do for the local economy, is butting up against their ideological loyalty in Congress. So you're seeing these sort of weird schisms appear in that regard.
Naomi, back to the very big picture. Your climate fiction was modestly titled The Collapse of Western Civilization. Did you put a date on it? Would you put a date on it today?
We did put a date on it. So in our story, we're looking back from the future into back to the year 2193. And that was based on, so in our story, the word collapse has a dual meaning. It's a double entendre. First, there's the collapse of the West Antarctic Ice Sheet, which Stan Robinson referred to. This is a real possibility. Scientists have known about this for a long time. We don't have a clear sense of when this could happen, but we know that it's not just science fiction. I mean, as we all know, the core of all good science fiction is science fact. So in my own research on Roger Revelle, who was one of the first American scientists to speak up on this issue and to reach out to policymakers, he used to always talk about the year 2100, and he worried that by the year 2100, the West Antarctic could become unstable. So that was my benchmark year, 2100. But I wanted it to be in this century because I think it's very easy for people to discount the next century. So I wanted it to be in the 21st century. And since 7 is a magic number, I subtracted 7 from 2100 and got 2093.
Can you count that high, Greg Lindsay? And I want to ask you, you're such a cheerful man. Do you get scared?
I get scared all the time. I'm a parent of two young children, and I get scared all the time thinking about the future. And then I also think about my parents' generation, and I think about the 1970s, and I think about Paul Ehrlich's The Population Bomb, and I think about the Club of Rome forecasting collapse. And they were both wrong. And they weren't wrong because they were inevitably wrong. They were wrong because there were titanic efforts to change the future. Norman Borlaug and the Green Revolution that fed the world in the 1970s, the changes in technology that led to certain metals and other scarce resources being devalued while others were elevated. You know, the future is always changeable. We're always inventing it. So we need to work together to change these futures. We can do it if we try, if we can tell ourselves the stories that can imagine these new futures to do it.
Okay, so I have to jump in here as the historian on this phone call, on the show. So I totally agreed with the second half of what Greg just said. I totally agree. The future is still up for grabs. We have the power to have different futures. I mean, Stan said the same thing. So I totally agree with that. And I totally agree that people have tremendous capacity to change the world, their communities, and themselves when they put their minds to it. We've seen that so many times in history. But it's a mistake, and I hear people say this a lot about how Paul Ehrlich was wrong. I really want to take objection to that because people are conflating, I think, two different things which are really important. Paul Ehrlich was a man who wrote a book with his wife, who should have got credit but didn't, Ann Ehrlich. And that book, you know, we can argue about that book in what ways it was right and what
ways it was wrong. We could argue about Norman Borlaug and the Green Revolution, too.
Well, hold on. And Norman Borlaug himself, later in his own life, said that the Green Revolution wasn't what he thought it was. It had been a disappointment to him because they didn't take into account adequately the social and political and cultural factors involved in food distribution. So the Green Revolution is a lot more complicated than most people make it out to be. But if we could just stick with population for a minute.
No, we can't. We're going to take a break, Naomi Oreskes and Greg Lindsay. Coming up, the myth of that little Dutch boy who put his finger in the dike and saved his country. The best part is where the story came from. This is Open Source. What we're missing, an MIT architect told me this week, is a narrative of adaptation, even a memory of the radical adaptations that made this American landscape. Rafi Siegel is new to Boston, but he starts with a point that we often forget, that our city was defined by the leveling of hills to fill in natural bays and swamps, miles and miles of them, that could easily revert to water as sea levels rise. He goes on to say that in Holland, that sort of transition in the imagination from water to land to water and back is part of the national myth. And that is not the end of Rafi Siegel's story.
We want to go back in time very quickly and then fast forward again. Even if we do it for Boston for its, you know, 400 years or so, we start off with these kind of set of islands, a natural harbor, the city grows, right? Land is infilled, etc. Expands to the suburbs, right? It starts with a nucleus. And in time now, and I'm kind of fast-forwarding to the future, where the concentration is also kind of gets diffused, and part of that concentration is no longer in downtown or in the kind of this city center, right? But perhaps gets moved to kind of peripheries, right, sub-centers, multi-centers. And then gradually the ocean kind of comes back in and takes over parts. And in time, they kind of also, there's still some footprints, but they gradually kind of disappear back into this new kind of semi-engineered, semi-natural landscape of water, land. A hill that was once is no longer, perhaps a neighborhood. There are pieces left, maybe only very light kind of marks of where your house used to be. You could visit it by boat, you know, tie your boat on a pier next to where your house was. Maybe you could still go there on weekends.
You're talking about where my house is right now, on filled-in land 150 years ago.
Yeah, so maybe in 150 years, you know, your great-grandkids will come here by boat and say, hey, you know, we used to have a house here, now we have a pool. We have a piece of water and land, maybe we can kind of hang out here for a few hours and picnic, but we have a nice, very nice house and maybe an estate, or maybe we live in this new commune somewhere higher up in the hills of Brookline or further west.
Ravi Siegel, you know the Netherlands well. The lowlands, literally, of Europe, they're half underwater to begin with, and they've coped very inventively for hundreds and hundreds of years. What can they teach us?
That condition of living in water, with water, was really part of their narrative for centuries. It's not anything that is questioned. And they allowed their innovation and imagination to, in a way, to accept it because there was no other option, right? And to work with it. One could say that to be creative, right, you need certain limitations, perhaps. They were extremely creative with this condition. And when I say the narrative, you know, if we look at, you know, their literature, even this kind of children's stories, right? This children's story of the kid who puts his finger in the dam and saves the village. Yeah. I mean, it's something that Dutch kids, kind of a bedtime story, right? This is what it means to be a hero. This constant kind of relation to or understanding that there is a danger in water on the one hand, but on the other hand, water is what allows us to survive. So I think it's not only learning actual kind of solutions, whether engineered solutions, but also learning how they accept and approach the broader condition that they're in.
That was the architect and futurist at MIT, Ravi Siegel. The beauty of that bedtime story about the Dutch boy who plugged the dam is that it was an American writer, Mary Mapes Dodge, who made it famous in her book Hans Brinker and the Silver Skates back in 1865. American kids used to know it better than the Dutch. So the spirit of it might still be lurking in our collective heads. What do you think, Greg? I mean, what's the narrative? What's your narrative ahead?
I don't know. It's a narrative ahead where we're going to have to rethink our relationship with the water. We're going to have to rethink our relationship with our neighbors. We're going to have to rethink our relationships with our government, with our cities. You know, the one of the big problems in America is that, you know, the reality of the challenges we face require solutions and cooperation that just simply can't be achieved by what we have right now. And that was part of my project with Rafi that we did, that we worked on together, was thinking about how states could band together and cities could band together to create these new forms of governance and cooperation that could start to deal with these challenges locally.
You mentioned that before. Is that, do you mean to say that the Paris Agreement is still effectively on if California and others still subscribe?
Well, one of the great ironies is that the Paris Accord is still valid. The United States doesn't begin to withdraw until the day after the election in 2020, which is a great symbolic moment. But yeah, I think we're going to see, you know, we've seen corporations, individuals, states pledge to continue the Paris Accords, which is all part of this sort of great discontinuous splintering that's been going on for 40 years. You know, we've seen around the world where, you know, governance is breaking down from the nation state model in ways that are both good and very bad.
I wonder, Naomi, do you have a narrative to take us forward?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I like getting back to what Stan said, I feel like we're, you know, we are at a bit of a juncture and it could go in a lot of different ways. I guess just listening to what's being said, I agree with most of what's been said, and I do think there's lots of grounds for optimism and that a lot of good things are happening around the world. But at the same time, I've spent a lot of time traveling this country and talking to people in places like Texas and Utah. And I don't know, I think there's just a heck of a lot of people around this country who don't share the sense of urgency that we do here in Boston.
Well, Texas surely must.
Maybe that's changed in the last 2 weeks. I certainly hope it has. I think we don't yet know. But what I worry about, and I hate to be the kind of pessimist in the room because that's not a fun place to be. I'd rather be the optimist. But you know, after Katrina, a lot of things people thought things would change. After Sandy, everyone said, oh, it's different now. But there's a way in which we slip back and we revert. And that's my worry right now.
Greg, have you seen solar panels in those red states?
Yeah, you see them sprouting up. You see people doing it because it makes economic sense to them, not because they've had any great change of heart. And Naomi's right. I mean, in the absence of any great political change or change in consciousness, the only thing you can fall back on is economic sense in the market. And obviously, she pointed out, not even free markets are really free. So, you know, so yeah, our best hope, our narrowest best hope, is that people will continue to do this because it makes individual sense to them. And that's why people fall back on technological fixes, is that, you know, that the best thing you can do is try to provide a way out of the trap by providing a better mousetrap, so to speak. And so, you know, we'll see those solar panels sprout in red states. We're seeing them sprout all over the world, as Chris pointed out. It's just that, you know, the question is, will it be enough in time? And current trajectories suggest no.
Rafi was speaking about lessons from the Netherlands. Naomi, I wonder who else out there in the wider world has stuff to teach us? Examples.
Well, everyone has stuff to teach us. I mean, this is the great American conceit that we're, you know, that we're always ahead on everything, and that's clearly not true. I mean, there's so much innovation going on. I mean, in India right now, Greg mentioned that earlier. I mean, I met some executives from a major Indian energy company now who are developing work on a prototype for offshore wind generation in which the energy would be stored as compressed air. And that's a pretty cool idea when you think about it, since compressed air is totally non-toxic, and if it leaks, so what? So I think there's a lot of innovative things happening in China, in India. There's also a lot of off-grid electrification happening in India now. I think Greg already suggested this. There's tremendous opportunities for distributed energy, and I think that, to me, that seems like the most exciting place going forward. I think, you know, there's been a lot of really good work done on grid integration and about how renewables can penetrate the market more thoroughly with grid integration. But I also think there's a lot of very exciting things happening in off-grid distributed energy as well.
You know, we haven't spoken of China. Greg, what do you know? I mean, they virtually, you know, claimed the territory of renewable energy. What more do we need to know?
Well, I mean, in China's case, I mean, they're seizing the moment not because of any particular, you know, ideology of sustainability, but because their cities are so choked by smog that the powers that be fear uprising if they don't address it. So they're, you know, while we're ruled by the market, they're ruled by the fear of the subjects they're governing. And so they're moving into that gap to take control. And also, of course, you know, there's the argument that this is the, you know, the commanding heights of the 21st century economy will be clean energy, and your ability to export that globally, you know, when people turn up to say, save us, you know, who will control that technology? Although Naomi's point, too, I mean, the example that I look to for hope is Germany's Energiewende, which is their great energy transformation to renewables. And not because, well, in this case, it's the whole transition from coal and nuclear to wind and solar. And I'm very hopeful about it, not because it's been a great success. It's arguably been a partial failure, because on days where the wind does not blow and the sun does not shine, they have to import electricity over the grids from their coal-burning neighbors. And it's led to weird swings in consumer electricity prices, which has created some rumbling. But by and large, there is a strong political will in Germany to accept it. That is part of the price of the transition and transformation of their economy in the name of climate change. And that gives me hope. I mean, they have bought into that as a mission, not just because they get lower electricity. So, you know, I'm hoping we could have a similar change in consciousness, or it can be, you know, the Manhattan Project that everyone comes back to as a metaphor. We need another Apollo program, another Manhattan Project.
The Save Manhattan Project.
Yeah, something that can save us. And it's interesting, too, that, you know, the one thing that always binds Americans together is national security. And, you know, the army, the military, the national security establishment has all said that climate change is an existential threat. They are sounding the alarm here. And yet our politicians still don't listen to that. I don't know what that will take. But they're calling for a Manhattan Project as well.
What will it take? Naomi, you're talking about undercoverage of important news from around the world. I had this weird sense of Scott Pruitt, the Trump administration generally, trying to reinforce some sort of bubble of free markets and what, you know, coal is good for you or something. But there's a wink there. Something they can't hold out. Can they?
Well, I don't know if they can. They're certainly going to try. I mean, there's an optimistic reading of what's going on, which is that this is last desperate gasp of the fossil fuel industry and their cronies to do everything possible they can against all evidence, all facts, all reason. So I don't think we know, but I think in terms of what we need, I think the thing that is clear that we do need that we haven't talked about yet tonight is a political movement, because I think it's very clear that cheaper prices for electricity are not enough. They're important, and we need to do everything we can to make renewables as cheap and as accessible as possible, but it's not enough. It's not enough because of the taxation structure, because of even, let's say, here in Massachusetts, how incredibly complicated it is. And I know because I went through this, the ridiculous amounts of paperwork it took to get my solar panels approved.
Really?
So there's a lot of obstacles. There are a lot of structural obstacles. So those have to be addressed. But how do you address structural obstacles? Well, you address them with movements, with political movements. And, you know, Greg just mentioned about political will. Germany didn't do what it did just because renewables were cheaper or they thought they would be do it. They did it because they believed it was the right, they wanted to be on the right side of history, and they thought that they could lead, and that if they led, it would have both political and economic benefits for them.
Naomi, so, you're reminding me that we raised the question last week, who's the Bernie Sanders for the climate crisis, which is to say a popular politician thinking about the common good. I have a friend from the old EPA who said, Chris, the Bernie Sanders of the climate crisis is Bernie Sanders. Could it be?
Well, I don't know if that's true. You know, I think, again, Greg just said a few minutes ago, he said we're ruled by the market. But I actually don't think that's true. I think we're ruled by the ideology of markets. And so we have to have a conversation about that. And I think someone is going to trigger that conversation, but I don't think we yet know who it is. And I honestly, personally, don't think it's going to be Bernie Sanders. I think it's going to be someone younger. And maybe somebody from the West.
Do you have a candidate, Greg? And do you believe, you didn't endorse wholesale the rule of markets, did you?
No, I agree with the ideology of markets, sure. I mean, to go back to Kim at the beginning, you know, my favorite Frederick Jameson quote is, it's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism.
We love that line. Yes. Say it again.
It's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. But speaking of like many Americans who've looked enviously north to Canada, which today, by the way, canceled a major pipeline to the east of the country to ship tar sand oil out there.
Yeah.
I look to someone like Naomi Klein, who has pointed out, I think increasingly rightfully, that the future of capitalism and the future of climate are entwined, and you cannot dismantle one without dismantling the other. And perhaps it'll be someone of her generation. I mean, she comes from socialist family royalty in Canada.
Naomi Klein does.
Her parents were very committed and famous socialists in Canada as well. So, it'll be curious to see what kind of charismatic figure who's been steeped in this their entire life and believes it and can communicate it. We obviously have figures like Bill McKibben, but that younger prophet has yet to emerge.
Naomi Klein, Naomi, forgive me, the Naomis, Oreskes.
Yes, I'm not Naomi Klein.
The national myth that is being reinforced, Ronald Reagan loved it, was the old shining city on a hill. We're all scrambling to get up the hill now. Where are we going, really?
Well, I don't think we know. I mean, I don't think any of us know. I think that's why this is a frightening moment. I mean, there are positive signs on the horizon. There's some really frightening signs on the horizon. And, you know, you've been saying throughout this hour, reminding us about what President Trump is doing, what Scott Pruitt is doing. We don't really know. We're at a crossroads. And that's why I think this is a really crucial moment for all of us, and that everybody's got to get involved and do what they can. This is a tough moment.
I want to know more about what China is actually putting on the market. They seem to have gotten the news.
Well, I mean, massive wind installations out in the West, massive solar PV installations. I mean, they're doing sort of everything in the menu all above. And then, of course, you know, there's their whole commitment to battery technology as well, which I think Kim pointed out at the very top of it, you know, is arguably the key to this.
Yes.
Chris.
Does anybody want to explain how those batteries work? What's different? What's new?
Well, it's simply, you know, there's no Moore's law when it comes to battery, but there appears to be a sort of a 7% improvement year over year. There is a holy grail. I mean, lithium air would be the actual technology that could be the real breakthrough to create ultra lightweight, long lasting batteries, but that's still in a lab and still unperfected. But you know, there's still room to go there. And yeah, once you can achieve true grid scale storage of energy, I mean, that changes the whole game on renewables. So that's one of the big breakthroughs. The other technology, if you want to talk about silver bullets, is a solar leaf, which has been talked about, that can really, an ability to basically create water and oxygen quickly out of, you know, basically simulate photosynthesis. I mean, that could do a ton for solving our energy water nexus as well. But again, that's, you know, that could happen tomorrow. That could never happen. It's one of those things that are completely unpredictable.
Tell me, some American corporations are into battery tech and lithium air.
Well, I mean, yeah, huge investments, you know, by major companies. I mean, all the big battery makers, Panasonic in Japan, L2 in Korea. You know, we're seeing huge investments. Tesla is big into this as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's hope out there. It's just a question of who can commercialize it, who can build the gigafactories of tomorrow to actually build these batteries.
We're feeling just a tiny bit better. Greg Lindsay and Naomi Oreskes, thank you both. Thanks also to Rafi Siegel, Chris Turner, and Kim Stanley Robinson, and to Jesse Keenan and Jeremy Grantham. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, and Becca DiGregorio. Susan Coyne does our watercolor illustrations online. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time for Open Source.